Hey everybody, welcome to TCP Talks with Jonathan Baker and Justin Broadley from the Cloud Pod. In this series, we're bringing you interviews with the best and brightest leaders and heroes from the tech and cloud industry.
Welcome to another fantastic episode of TCP Talks. Jonathan, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks, Justin.
Well, I have an exciting guest for us this week, William Morgan, CEO of Buoyant. You might not have heard of Buoyant if you're not too heavily into the Kubernetes space, but they are a big part of the Kubernetes ecosystem as the core product is Linkerd, which is one of the open source Kubernetes service meshes out there. And so I'd love to introduce William to you and have him introduce himself a little bit more and what he does and his amazing background, which is quite extensive here in the Bay.
Yeah, thanks. Hi, Justin. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, my name's William Morgan. You may not have heard of Buoyant, as you so politely introduced me, but you've probably heard of Linkerd if you're in the Kubernetes space. We were the first service mesh, the project that coined the term. We were like the fifth ever project to join the CNCF. So we've kind of been boots on the ground in the Kubernetes ecosystem since the very early days. And then we're just about to celebrate our 10-year anniversary of Linkerd. So yeah, exciting times.
It's actually the one that I can say I've used, which is
that's right.
Nice. Because normally that's some of the other service meshes I'm aware of, but I've not personally engineered anything on. So it's good.
Meshes too. We don't have to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think some of the interesting things, you know, where did Linkerd come from? I know, you know, you had a past life in the Twitter world, pre-Elon and the good old days of Twitter. That kind of brought Linkerd about, and then you donated it to the CNCF. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, you're one of the first founders we've had talk about, who's been a CNCF member. I'm just kind of curious how that came to be, the idea behind Linkerd, how all that evolved into becoming what Buoyant is today, 10 years in.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, you're exactly right. The origin story was a bunch of work that we did at Twitter, you know, at that point, and this was 2010 to like 2014, you know, when I started at Twitter as an infrastructure engineer, it was a monolithic Ruby on Rails stack. And by the time I left a couple of years later, it had turned into this big distributed system. In this case, running on the JVM and like using C groups and like on Mesos. So like very different from kind of the Kubernetes world of today, at least at the surface level, but the underlying mechanics were all the same. You know, we had orchestration, we had containerization, at least in some form, and we had these big old distributed systems. And the origin for us in the early days of Buoyant was, you know, one of the things Twitter had to figure out in that migration was, well, how do we manage the communication between these services at scale? You know, because we used to have this monolithic Ruby on Rails stack. We used to have function calls. A would call B, would call C, would call D. Like, what do we know of function calls? Well, they basically never fail, and they're super fast. Thank you, Apple, for that decoration. The network calls, and the network calls were super slow, relatively, and would fail all the time, and you'd have all these distributed systems issues. You know, Twitter had to invent a bunch of technology to kind of handle that, and that technology, actually literally the open source, you know, version of these Scala libraries was the very first version of Linkerd. And for us, we were like, okay, you know, Twitter has done all this stuff. We feel like every other company in the world is going to need to tackle the same, you know, to tackle the same challenges. And that's basically what happened in a different form. You know, now we're using Kubernetes and Docker, like all these things that Twitter didn't have. But that was kind of those initial moments.
Fantastic. You know, you've been claimed to, people say you coined the term service mesh. Curious, you know, as you think of the market now 10 years in of the service mesh and, you know, containerization and Kubernetes and the maturity that's happened there, how do you see it's evolved and how has it really stayed the same over these last 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely evolved. You know, like I said, when we joined the CNCF, we were the fifth project ever. And so it was a super early and exciting time, especially for a smaller project like Linkerd. And there was like Kubernetes and Prometheus and etcd and something else. And then Linkerd, we were like, whoa, this is amazing. Nowadays, the CNCF ecosystem is incredibly large and rich, and there's all these different tiers and things like that. And I'd say it's evolved largely in the way that you kind of hope any mature technology evolves, which is like in the early days, it was exciting and it was fresh and new, and people were like, what is this thing? And what is this funny name? And now it's like this boring thing, and our job is basically to make Linkerd as boring as possible. You get that thing working, you know, and like then you move on with your life and you solve the other problems. So it's kind of like a different mindset. You know, obviously I play kind of two roles in this. One is I'm trying to shepherd the project. The other is, I have a company that basically funds this project full time, and we have to hire the maintainer. So I also have to figure out kind of like the commercial side of this, and like, how do we keep Linkerd viable? How do we make sure, you know, we've been around for 10 years. My goal is to get us to 100 years. So what is a system that we need in place in order to, that we can say with a straight face, hey, you can rely on Linkerd because we're going to be around for another 90 years. So that part has certainly evolved a lot since the early days as well.
I mean, to be successful going into the future, I'm sure that it's heavily going to involve AI in some ways. And so how is Linkerd evolving to now take care of this AI world that we're now in, especially the networking level? Things like inference access becomes a big deal. How do you manage gating access to LLMs, et cetera?
Yeah, look, there's a lot of technology, you know, like kind of fads that have come and gone, and I've kind of like closed my eyes and been like, I don't think this is real. Like NFTs were like a super hot thing. And to a certain extent, like I just ignore them. I was like, that doesn't seem real to me. And they kind of went away. And, you know, arguably, most of crypto is the same thing. At least I've ignored it. But for AI, you know, like there's no escape. You know, like we got to face reality here. If nothing else, because, you know, every one of our Linkerd users and our Buoyant customers are like, they're in the thick of it right now too. And they're struggling to figure out, okay, what does this mean for us and how are we changing? You know, we can't just ignore it and be like, yeah, you're on your own. We have to understand what those challenges are, and we have to provide the tools that we can on their behest. So like on the one hand, it's like, you know, do we want to add AI to Linkerd? Well, no. Not really. Like what is Linkerd needs to be, you know, we're an infrastructure layer, you know, and like we have to be fast and we have to be predictable and we have to be like really lightweight. And AI is kind of the opposite of all those, or generative AI, you know, it's like kind of the opposite of all these things. It requires a ton of memory and it's like unpredictable and it's slow. So, you know, we're not going to like add AI to Linkerd, but, you know, like I said, we kind of do have this duty to help our users and our customers like figure out, you know, how are they going to operate in this new world? And that starts with, what are the challenges that they actually have, right? Like we know, so our users, our customers, they're on the platform side, right? They're the team typically that owns a Kubernetes cluster, that owns a platform. They're, you know, that's kind of our ICP, that's our customer profile. And their jobs, you know, their customers internally are the devs, right? And like the devs are, there, if you look in an organization, that's kind of like the front line for AI adoption right now. Like that's a thing, you know, that AI is really awesome at, especially since like last November, is the code side of things. So, okay, the devs have all been like super AI empowered. Well, what does that mean for the platform team? And I think you could look at it through a couple lenses. And I'll say our view right now is pretty exploratory. Well, exploratory sounds maybe advanced exploratory. Like we are trying to understand what these problems are. The problems are changing from day to day. But there's a set of things you can look at. Like one is you just look at what are the first order effects? No, what are the second order effects? Like maybe the devs now are like cranking out so much more code that like your CI, CD system is under pressure because like you got 10x of deploys. Okay, you know, is that happening? I haven't really seen that, but maybe the devs are cranking out really shitty code because they're all vibe coding everything. And now like all these security considerations that we used to kind of be able to wink, wink, nudge, nudge our way around. Well, now we can't do that because now like the code's real down. I haven't really seen that yet either, but maybe we're getting there. And then you get into like the more kind of the more sophisticated kind of world where you're like, all right, well, one thing that definitely is happening is some of our platform users are running inference themselves. They're being tasked with, okay, you got to run this inference because we're trying to build it into our product. And we don't want this to be like, we don't want, from a business perspective, we don't want our product to be like a margin on top of Anthropic or on top of AI, OpenAI. Like we want to run our own inference. Okay, so that's definitely interesting. And then there's a whole kind of almost unrelated world of like, well, we want to use, you know, we're agentic now. We want to do all this agentic shit and we want these like agentic workloads running in the production ecosystem. Well, no one's quite been brave enough to do that, probably for good reasons, but that's kind of the direction everyone is starting to move. So all of that stuff is just rich, fertile, loamy soil for interesting product stuff for us to do.
Do you think you need to make changes at the service mesh layer to support these are the different style of workloads? I mean, you know, API calls are going to be as fast as possible because that's what everyone wants, but inference is by definition slow and takes time. Do you think you need to change Linkerd in any way to support that type of use case, long running multiple sessions? You know, does memory use change? What sort of changes about the way you think about implementing a service mesh when the shape of the jobs fundamentally change?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a couple directions. The first is, yeah, from like the service mesh perspective, these inference, actually running inferences is like, this is the easiest possible kind of workload. You know, oh, your latency requirements are so lax on it. Oh, your response is like, takes 13 seconds for a response. Well, if we add, you know, we're like struggling to add 9 milliseconds instead of 10 milliseconds. Oh, now, you know, who cares, right? It's 13 seconds. Sure. And how many of these things do you have? You have 10,000. You don't have 10,000 of them. You've got maybe 20 of them, you know, because they're really expensive. So, you know, in some ways that part's easier. What has become a lot more interesting is the routing layer. It's the way that these inference workloads work is they're really, really, really slow, but they're also really amenable to caching. So if you are really smart about how you're routing the pods and you send it to the engine that's running on the GPU that already has the KV cache, like pre-populated for this particular, well, you know, now you've saved, you know, from 13 seconds, you've gone to like 1 second. Okay, that's economic value there. So suddenly routing decisions, like kind of informed routing decisions, become really, really interesting. And then kind of on the flip side, you know, a lot of the kind of agentic adoption or proto adoption, you know, the way that seems to be evolving, at least we see in our users and customers, is you have some, you know, agentic like workloads doing something. Who knows? You're calling an LLM in a loop ultimately. But it, you know, the point of this thing is it's supposed to access some system or some service that's pre-existing, that's non-agentic. And that system is important. That system has like, it's your database, it's got your financial transactions in it or whatever. Right. And so now you have this, you kind of have this boundary in between the two things where you've got like really important, legally protected database shit over here. And then you've got like the agentic workload over there. What is that boundary? Well, right now we're saying that's MCP. We're like, oh, we've got this protocol. And like, you know, so right, the service mesh could parse MCP. And in fact, we have a prototype of Linkerd doing this already. We could parse, we could emit metrics, we could give you like kind of security guarantees around that. Okay, that first step to tackle. But I think the problem space there is much, much larger, right? Like fundamentally, you have something that's untrusted, which is this agentic workload, but you need to give it access to like a bunch of important data in order to make progress. And how do you really navigate that relationship there? You know, service mesh kind of sits in a really interesting level because we're sitting in front of the database. We're sitting in front of the, you know, the user service. We're sitting in front of the like medical records service. And we have the, you know, the opportunity to provide some kind of protection there if we can figure out like what is the right thing to protect, you know, and how do we want to parameterize this, and like how much intelligence is in that layer. But that boundary between the two sides, I think, is super interesting to explore.
Yeah, it becomes difficult because everyone's going to have their own use cases. Some people may have customers and customer IDs. Other people may have other types of data or other keys which become relevant to agentic workloads. Mm-hmm. So I guess building a system that is abstract enough to let customers apply it to their own use cases without, you know, while still covering all these security and compliance requirements is going to be pretty tough.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And you know, kind of pre-AI, the model that people were using was, you know, we called it like zero trust security or whatever. It was basically like, hey, I want to lock things down to the extent, you know, to the point where I can, if I'm getting really fancy, there's like, obviously, you know, service A is not allowed to talk to service B, right? Okay, that's one level. And then if you're really sophisticated, well, service A is allowed to call the slash delete and or the slash add endpoint, but not the slash delete endpoint, something like that. But that starts falling apart pretty quickly, I think, when you have these uncontrolled, unconstrained LLM workloads. You know, and so, yeah, how do you parameterize that? What's the right levels of how customizable is that? You know, is this like a CRD that you're writing, or is this like, do you have to give people the ability to write, you know, JavaScript code to describe their exact thing? Like, I think it's all kind of TBD. You know, the only thing that's certain is like this agentic workload at some point, it's going to figure out how to delete the production database and it's going to try it. Like at some point, you know what's going to happen. So you can't turn a blind eye to this. Okay. So however you're rolling this out, you got to have some protection in place because otherwise that's exactly what's going to happen. Have you looked at the AI Darwin Awards? Oh, it's great.
I haven't seen that specifically, but I see plenty of candidates on Reddit. Yeah. It's like, you know, ChatGPT deleted, you know, wipe my machine. Like, why do you let it do that?
Yeah. And then my favorite is then they like interrogate the agent afterwards. They're like, why did you decide to do this? Oh, I'm sorry. It was a really bad idea. You know, and you're like, it's not like this is a, you know, like a criminal that you've like locked up in jail and you're trying to interrogate. Like, it's just a, you know, it's just a chatbot. Like,
I see people swearing at things like, why did you do that?
Right.
I'm like, well, what's the point in this? You know, a bad workman blames his tools, I think, is what I typically revert back to. You know, I think it's going to be interesting because while you could have a policy, like a routing policy for like, say, the first call, it sort of fans out to different things, you know, so you're making the call to the agent, which is going to decide what to do. And then that may reach out to a database or another service or something else. You almost need sort of this causal chain of trust from end to end. So maybe the service mesh sort of needs to be aware of the full extent of the call end to end and not just a single step.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. So, you know, really you kind of want this authority to be passed, you know, at a per request level rather than at the connection level. Yes. Yeah. And those mechanics are, you know, we kind of like have those mechanics today with distributed tracing where like you're propagating this context around between things. But like what's in there and, you know, what's the identity and like, are you acting on behalf of Jonathan or is this like, you know, all those things. People have proposals and people have ideas and certainly a lot of, you know, companies that see the dollar signs ahead of them are like writing out like, wow, here's how you solve agentic identity. I don't know, man. I don't know. We'll see how that evolves.
How does that move into zero trust as well? Because it's probably one of the most overloaded things I hear all the time from all the security vendors. And I assume it has some context in an idea of an agentic user, an agentic identity, as well as the service mesh impact.
Yeah, I would say, you know, the philosophy behind zero trust is, if anything, it's just more relevant. The problem with zero trust is it got, you know, overloaded with like 100 different things. But if you look at the philosophy behind it, you're like, yeah, this makes sense, right? It's like, you know, you should have to authorize and authenticate at every step in the chain. And like, just because you're within the data center boundary doesn't mean that you're like, you're given all, you know, permissions to do anything you want. Okay, sure, makes sense. And you should do that at the most granular level possible. Well, yeah, of course. You know, I'd say if anything, the temperature has just been turned up because you used to get away with the fact that, you know, yeah, our data, you know, once you're in the data center, the database, you know, it's kind of accessible by anyone. But all the code that's running in here, well, it went through 3 rounds of peer review and like, we're all smart engineers and we're all, you know, trying to do the right thing. And so if this database doesn't have a lot of protections in front of it, you know, it's a risk, but it's, you know, it's one of many risks. Now, right now that code, like I said, now that code, it's just a matter of time before it's going to delete the database. So it's kind of not optional anymore. You know, you can
in
the past.
You know, because engineers aren't as creative as I am because I ran an ops for a long time. So when you get into like a failure mode event analysis and you're trying to figure out all those different scenarios, I'm like, your imaginations aren't as good as mine. I've seen it all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of nice to see people now realizing like with, you know, people experimenting with OpenClaw and it leaking their information to the internet or, you know, dropping their production database. And I was like, yeah, these are all the things that you used to think I was crazy for pushing in the FMEA, but like, you know, I've seen all these things happen from, you know, fat fingering and you know who fat fingers really fast? AI. So it's definitely interesting.
Face and then, you know, Yeah. And a lot of confidence.
A lot of confidence. And yeah, you're right. I shouldn't have done that. Like, thanks. Thanks for acknowledging me.
Right. I think, you know, I think the one of the dangers with this, you know, and it's almost an artifact of the fact that the way we're interacting with these things is through chatbots, is we start anthropomorphizing them, right? And we're like, oh, I'm talking to this guy over here who's like helping me with my code. And you know, this guy says a lot of, you know, correct things, and you start letting your guard down. And then you're like, you know, most of the time they're correct. You know, and you don't realize that the surface area of what they're able to do is like so weird compared to the surface area of what a human is able to do. You know, there's like a set of things that they're really excellent at, and then there's a whole set of other things that's just not there at all. And so you start letting your guard down. You treat it like, oh yeah, this is, you know, you're treating this like an intern. You're treating it like an optimistic, but a little confused intern. And then, you know, boom. So yeah, database gets deleted.
Yeah, I think they're very good at doing exactly what you tell them to do, but they lack the maturity of somebody who's been a senior developer and who's worked in a business and who understands the business requirements. I think of all the failures that I've seen, and I've had plenty of failures in my own projects using Claude Code or other coding assistance, all the failures seem to come down to not providing enough rails or guards to keep it on the right track. And it only takes one small decision. 3 days ago, it decided that actually this requirement that I had was optional. And, you know, you go down this path, and all of a sudden, why is it doing this? Oh, well, you know, 3 days ago, I decided that we could go down this path. And it's like, no, that was not what I wanted.
Idiot.
it's hard to be annoyed at the tool. But at the same time, you know, it doesn't always respect everything that you say. It thinks there's flexibility. And I think English language or any language is just so vague. And the way we use it colloquially between ourselves, you know, I have an understanding and you have an understanding, and we agree we have a shared understanding, but we don't have that same connection. You know, we don't have a relationship in the same way. And so it's really easy for things to be misunderstood and to go off the rails very, very rapidly.
Yeah.
At the same time, I mean, what a fantastic piece of technology.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. It's like you spend half an hour with this and you're like, oh my gosh, this is actually saving me a ton of time. You know, I've spent over the weekend, I was having it like debug, you know, this issue on my Kubernetes cluster. And I was like, oh man, this thing is awesome at this. Like, actually, yeah, you're right. I never thought about that, but it probably is this. And like, what's the command I can run? Okay. You know, even OPSI stuff like that. That saved me so much time. I would have been stuck on that for a week, you know, frantically Googling and trying to find the right thing and reading through docs. So yeah, that's the scary part. So good. It's so good at some stuff and then it's so bad at other stuff, and you get tricked into complacency.
As a practitioner, we've been complaining for years about the complexity of Kubernetes, and you know, it's mm-hmm. a great powerful tool, but it's also very complicated and there's lots of sharp edges if you're not careful. And you know, that whole conversation has basically evaporated with the, you know, launch of AI agents that can now manage Kubernetes at scale and it can do a lot of those things. And so it's nice because now we get the power of Kubernetes with, you know, something that can actually understand and deal with the complexity of it and make it approachable to us through a chat, you know, interface is nice. But, you know, it's kind of a bummer too, because I do think Kubernetes could still take a lot of, you know, enhancements and making it less complicated. And I feel like that's going to be probably less of an interest in the community side for a while.
So there's going to be less pressure to like simplify the underlying primitives because AI can kind of like paper.
Exactly. It'll just paper over all of that complexity.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer. But maybe something better will come out of that as well. So we'll see. Everything evolves.
Yeah, that's interesting because like it's not evolving in a direction of simplicity, though. It's evolving in a direction of like solving complexity by adding more layers of complexity on top.
Right.
I think it's always been like that, though. I mean, we don't program computers on punch cards anymore, or by, you know, blowing fuses on an EEPROM. We don't use machine code. We don't program in the same language. All those things are incrementally abstracted and into these easier building blocks. I got a son who's 11, and you know, he's been using AI and he's been building games in Unity. And he has no understanding of an awful lot of the fundamentals, but he doesn't need to at this point because we have these mature Lego bricks that he can just stitch together and turn into amazing things. And I guess at some level, as long as those building blocks have reached a level of maturity, it's okay. I think we're not quite there yet for a lot of things. I'm okay with keeping the complexity as long as it's abstracted away into a reliable sort of unit that we can manage.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, and then the other thing is it's all moving so fast that, you know, all the intuitions I had built up, you know, in October of last year, I had to revisit in like March of this year because like things are
changing so quickly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What made sense 6 months ago, you know, in a different level of models doesn't make sense today. And I think that'll continue to happen. As these things continue to improve. I mean, Mythos got released in the last week, which apparently, mm-hmm. you know, is finding 25-year-old bugs in free BSD.
Yeah.
You know, it's things will continue to change and evolve, and it will probably get, you know, it'll be ebbs and flows of like, oh my God, all is lost, and oh my God, this is the next future that's amazing. And so we'll go through both sides of this coin probably back and forth for the next several years.
We've got an emotional roller coaster that we're all going to be partaking a mm-hmm. journey of.
You know, I know valid MCP support in the Benchprise version of Linkerd. That makes sense.
We have a prototype. We haven't
Adding. Okay. How are you concerned? You know, there's talk of the SaaSpocalypse and people can build anything they want with powerful coding tools. Are you concerned for companies like your own in general that AI will sort of eat your lunch effectively by enabling people to build things like Linkerd and not need to pay you?
Like, could someone build? I mean, it's funny because it's that for us, it's almost the same question as like, you know, the open source question. You know, Linkerd is fundamentally open source. So, like, why would anyone pay us? Why wouldn't they just run the open source thing? You know, and it turns out there's all sorts of reasons why. You know, as a company. You know, and I got to see this from both sides because, you know, obviously I'm trying to sell as much service mesh to as many people as possible, but also I'm buying a bunch of services and technology. You know, as a company, you're kind of allocating like where your money goes and where your risk goes and where your level of ownership goes. And, you know, there's a lot of cases where you're like, you know, I don't want to own that and I don't want to incur the risk and I want someone else to do that in exchange for money. And that's fundamentally like kind of the judgment that you're making everywhere and how much appetite you have for like running, operating your own service mesh and pulling that in as a purely open source dependency and keeping up with security, you know, and all that stuff versus being able to outsource that to a vendor. I mean, it depends. It depends on the company. But, you know, we try and make that trade-off as clear as possible. So, yes, you could rewrite Linkerd with AI if you wanted to. Or you could just take the existing code like it's there. Probably every model has been trained on it as well as on every other CNCF project there. So you don't need to rewrite Linkerd. You know, the code's already there for you. But I think fundamentally, you know, yes, the dynamics around creation of source code are different now. Like the cost of creating the source code is much less, but that's kind of been the path anyways in the industry. It's accelerated now, but that's been the path in the industry anyways. Like what's the value of owning this IP? Like it's kind of minimal because the point of software, like in order to get any use out of it, you got to run it and you got to operate it. And that's actually the hard, and you got to keep it up to date with the ecosystem around it. And like, that's the hard part. So the value of like writing the code has been diminishing over time, probably since the introduction of open source.
The your point on MCP that you made in your blog article, I just want to jump on real quick. You particularly mentioned the observability challenge and also the security side of it. How do you see Linkerd solving that? Because it's an interesting approach to come from the service mesh side of it. It makes sense. So I'm just curious how you're thinking about this a little bit more.
Yeah, well, so you got to look, you know, there's like the way that MCP is being used today, and then there's the way that people want to use it in the future. And so the way it's being used today, we actually don't, you know, the service mesh can't really do a lot with, because the way it's been used today is it's on developers' laptops. It's like I'm using my, you know, I'm using Claude and I'm attaching it to like the GitHub MCP server or whatever. And like that doesn't go through your production environment at all, right? That goes from like your developer's laptop to their SaaS server, whatever. What people want to do in the future is, you know, this like, hey, we're going to replace business processes with these agentic workloads, and they actually is going to run in the environment. So there, now, like we've been talking about, now you have this kind of unpredictable, or I would say anti-predictable workload running in there. How are you going to impose the protections? Well, you got two options, and maybe you do both of them. One option is we use an agentic library or framework to build this stuff, and that agentic framework is going to like add all these protections. Okay, that's one half of it. But then you also need the other half, which is like, hey, I have these existing services, right? I have my user service or my medical data service or my financial database or whatever. I need to add a protective layer around that, right? You want the server side protection. You can't just rely on client side protection. That's where the service mesh starts becoming useful. Those things are already there. You don't want to modify the code. You don't want to make them have some dependency on, you don't want to like rebuild your database or whatever to have some dependency on MCP. So you're going to protect it at the platform layer by adding like, you know, a little firewall in front of it. And that's basically what the service mesh proxy is it's like a little per pod firewall that can make enforcement decisions and things like that. So that's kind of where that sits. Now I'll say what we did, you know, in the prototype and what I think will be V1 of this is a pretty straightforward translation of like the existing security policy and things like that. I think that's necessary, but I don't think that's really sufficient in the long run for like fully protecting your MCP workload. So we did, you know, we took the low-hanging fruit there. I think the observability part of that is super, super interesting because once these things are in your data center, like what calls are they making? And like, what are they doing on those calls? Well, shit, you have no idea. I mean, you know, you see this 4-second HTTP call that goes to like slash MCP and it returns a 200. And you're like, okay, well, what happened there? So, you know, MCP is this weird ass protocol and it's JSON over RPC, stateful for some reason that no one knows why. And so like you can do some work at the service mesh level to expose some of those MCP kind of like, aspects out. So you can at least detect, hey, there's MCP traffic going over here. You know, you should know about that. Hey, here's an MCP server. Okay, well, you should be assembling a catalog of those things, right? Hey, here's the tool calls or the resource calls or whatever that happened. Okay, great. And then later on, so that's step one. Later on, you can say, well, actually, I want to add some kind of, more advanced protection in there. I want you to look for, some IP being exchanged. It's not supposed to leave the data center boundary or a credit card number or social security number. Like once you're in that kind of that layer where you are like protecting the database, that's where it becomes interesting to start implementing, you know, like agentic specific policies.
I think we need specific agentic policies. I mean, any service which was previously doing the same type of work on behalf of a customer request or reaching out to a database, we already had those controls in place for DLP and audit logging and things like this. What's special about the fact that it's an AI that's driving the product versus
that's a good question. I think what's, you know, there's kind of two things. You know, the first is kind of very generically, I will say, like the stuff that I would trust Jonathan to do and to access, I wouldn't necessarily trust an agent working on behalf of Jonathan to do and to access. So like, you know, if I know this code is written by, I don't mean to pick on you, Jonathan, I should say Justin. He's the troublemaker, self-announced troublemaker here, right? The database records I would trust Justin to access might be different from what I'm trusting some agentic workflow on his behalf to access. And then, you know, the other aspect is the raised temperature of the need for these things. Probably in most of these systems, I don't have that level of locked downness because the code that's been accessing them to date has been reviewed by human beings and maybe there's a security committee and blah, blah, blah. And now we don't have that anymore. So we cannot rely on those protections. Okay, so now we need to add protections that maybe should have been in there in the first place, but we're just, you know, like the risk reward, not the risk reward, the like cost benefit analysis wasn't there. Well, now the benefit is way, way higher. Right. So the cost, you know, the cost, which has been fixed, you know, the ratio is now in favor of like actually locking this stuff down.
It's sort of the reality of what we've always wanted. Because, you know, having built out open API platforms multiple times and always this dream of like, oh, you know, yeah, we create a UI and we have all this great stuff that accesses our APIs. But if you don't like our stuff, you can write your own. And, you know, the number of customers that would actually do that was less than 2%. and even that case is like a very specific niche use case that you typically hated because it was an edge case that was causing you all kinds of other grief in your system. And now we've taken all those APIs and we put them behind an MCP wrapper. And now that innovation is happening at a level that we're are not able to control. And so the opaqueness of the MCP combined with the fact that these API platforms we've built for years with this dream that customers could do exactly what we're now enabling is suddenly hitting everybody in the real way.
It's like, you know, you live in a safe neighborhood and you leave your keys in your car and you leave your front door unlocked. And then all of a sudden you have an infestation of raccoons. Mm-hmm. And raccoons are everywhere and they're like getting into stuff and they're eating your food and they're like pooping on your kitchen counter. I don't know. Like, okay, you know, we probably should have been locking our door the whole time. So like now we're going to do that.
Yeah. Awesome. Quotas matter. When before they were like, we just need people to use the API. We don't care about the quota. Now it's like, no, the quota matters because the MCP can burn these things pretty quickly. But yeah, it's just sort of fun because I've had some conversations recently about these edge cases and I'm like, yeah, well, this is what we've always been worried about was, you know, uncontrolled access to the API. And now with MCPs, it's now so much more accessible to even, you know, someone with a vibe coding solution can now vibe code to my MCP and get access to this data. And you're right. Do I want to interpret that as Jonathan as the AI, or does AI have its own access model? And this is a common debate we're seeing quite a bit now in the industry too. So these are all the challenges we get to solve in the next year or two.
I almost feel like MCP is like a red herring in that conversation. Cause like, even if we didn't have MCP, like, you know, this is true of all of our APIs. Like once you have this uncontrolled, unconstrained workload in your environment, like the environment has got to have like the defense mechanisms, you know, you got to have the immune system now. Ah, that's another great analogy. Yeah. Now we've purposefully introduced some like scary bacteria into our environment. It's going to be helpful, but like our immune system has to be there to keep the guardrails on.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think MCP is just the canary in that coal mine. It's like, hey, this is the warning that this is about to get worse. So luckily using tools like Linkerd and these others, you know, to help you secure your workloads will be important in this conversation. So I'm definitely intrigued with what you guys are doing on MCP's front and we'll keep checking it out.
If you don't use Linkerd, your data system will be overrun by raccoons.
There you go. That's the quote right there. Well, I know Linkerd has a pretty active blog. I know you were out there blogging on it as well. Some of your coworkers out there and you're very involved in the CNCF community around Kubernetes. Any other places that they should check out what you're posting on the internet? I mean, I used to be a Twitter, so maybe you're still a Twitter, but maybe you have other places you've gone now like the rest of us.
Yeah, no, I'm on other places, but really my personal output has turned into just podcasts and things. Occasionally LinkedIn. It's pretty sad. But no, you know, check out linkerd.io, check out buoyant.io. We have, you know, a pretty cool distribution of commercial distribution of Linkerd, but it's free to use if your company is fewer than 50 employees and got some extra bells and whistles in there. Yeah. Yeah, and then just you know, send me nasty grams on LinkedIn, I guess.
Sounds good.
Sounds awesome. Well, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a great conversation. Really interesting to hear about everything you guys are doing at Linkerd and how you're seeing some of these AI workflows and the network changing. And secure your API. That's the key thing. Keep the raccoons out.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys.
Visit thecloudpod.net to subscribe to the show, join our Slack channel, or sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also find information on reaching our audience through a Cloudpod sponsorship opportunity. A big thank you to today's guest, and thank you for listening.